Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. What if the future isn't a destination you predict? What if it's something you're already building? Right now, whether you realize it or not. Although if you're on a farm while you're listening to this, I suspect you do realize it. And so this question sits at the heart of this conversation that we're having today. My guest is Tiana Brand, a foresight practitioner who spent her career doing something genuinely difficult. Walking into rooms full of scientists, veterinarians, policy experts, and people who trust data and demand evidence, convincing them that imagining multiple futures isn't a soft exercise, it's a requirement of leadership. It's essential work. And she did that inside the World Organization for Animal Health, one of the oldest international bodies in existence. And she did it, as she put it, by stealth. What drew me into today's conversation is the particular tension Tiana navigates so well. On one side, you have sectors like ours, agri-food, animal health, rural communities, that are facing compounding complexity and crises. Climate, disease, trade, technology, trust, all of it colliding. And on the other side, you have organizations, leaders, and frankly, entire cultures that respond to that complexity by tightening their grip, narrowing their vision, and betting everything on certainty that they don't actually have. Tiana's argument, and it's a compelling one, is that humility isn't weakness in the face of an uncertain future. It might be the most practical leadership tool we have. So what does it actually look like to bring foresight into a sector that's skeptical of it? And what does it mean to lead when the future isn't one thing, but many? Let's get into it. Tiana, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thank you so much. It's good to meet you.
Now, we have a ritual that starts off every episode, which is meant to catch most of our guests kind of flat-footed. But in your case, you've kind of got a bit of an advantage when it comes to this question, which is, what does the future mean to you?
Oh, well, even somebody who practices foresight and thinks about future in multiples, that question can still catch us all off a guard. And sometimes it does. It depends on the situation and the person I'm talking to, and how I want to express myself. So in general, for me, the future is not one thing. It's multiple. It doesn't exist yet. It exists in our anticipation of those multiple futures. So in that sense, it can't be predicted. It can be created and shaped by the things that we do today. And I can go on about that if you like.
Right on.
Even in our English language, right? We thought we use present and past. And when we talk about the future, it is speculative. It's almost a hypothesis when we formulate our impressions of the future and we try to explain it. It remains uncertain and unknowable.
Well, and again, to your credit, you're the first person to introduce a plurality as an answer to that, in acknowledging that there are multiple, if not infinite, futures that are part of our understanding of that. Jen, why don't I bring you in here to kind of, I think in your own words, bring us to the past before we continue moving towards the future.
Yeah. So, Tiana, I met you years and years ago, and I'd love for you to talk about for us what it was like to bring forecasting into the world of the World Animal Health Organization, which is a 100-year-old organization? Like, how does one bring the concept of foresighting into such an aged being?
Well, with a bit of guts, I guess, especially in an organization which has a lot of scientists, veterinarians, you know, very looking for the evidence, if you will, the solid answer, you know, heavily reliant on science itself. And one thing that I had to go back to with a lot of my colleagues who are very open-minded people was to go back to how they think about risk and how they think about science. I mean, science was all speculation at one point until we started experimenting and doing repetition within those experiments. And even today, we are learning things that we thought we knew, that we thought we knew, and that we don't know through experimentation. And also thinking about it from a risk perspective, you know, working in an environment where they are already scanning the horizon for what is emerging in terms of diseases and looking at it from an emergency management perspective. When you think about the cycle of emergency management, you are anticipating as well, and you're preparing. So using that type of language, it made it kind of interesting for them to go, oh, okay, right. We seem to be quite siloed in our way of thinking about what risk looks like, how risks emerge, etc. But we also know, just, you know, based on our own experiences, that it's never going to come at us in one direction. It's going to come at us from multiple directions. So thinking about how politics might play out or economics might play out in an emergency situation, how weather will play out in an emergency situation. It's not going to be just this nice little disease modeling type of situation where we've put a lot of parameters around, and the reason we wanted to do that was to keep our decision making tight. And every disease outbreak tells you something new and probably something that you knew about and probably should have reacted to. And so, you know, these ideas of the lessons learned, maybe we should be more mindful of what else is going on in the world, you know, prior to rushing out with responses or coming up with a solution or what have you, because sometimes those solutions can cause other problems. So yes, it was a bit of like, why do we need this? We already do horizon scanning as it is, you know, we're looking at PubMed and we're looking at rumors and everything else to find out what is happening in the world in terms of disease outbreaks and potential disease outbreaks. Why do we need to do this? And it was really about, well, there are more outcomes than what we think we'd like to see. So that was a way to kind of bring people along with that idea of doing not forecasting, not just disease modeling. Those are the foreseen stuff, but bringing in the unforeseen and what can you work with that?
Well, and to what extent is humility kind of central to the process of foresight? And I say that in a cultural context in which arrogance and certainty seems to drive a lot of products that would be in the kind of intelligence or the dashboard space. Because mm-hmm. what you're describing, again, couched in the context of risk management, does seem to run counter to the culture, at least the business culture, that a lot of organizations look to when dealing with the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, a lot of people don't like to be wrong. I think that's where maybe you're coming from as well. Like, there's that idea of holding tightly to prediction. And look, if you get it right, it's a bit of luck, I think, rather than actually solid, you know, prediction here. So yes, there is that sense of the humility needs to be brought along with this. And where is nice to center around that is nobody's been to the future and back. Show me somebody who has. And And have we listened to that person as well? If they had, you know, I mean, there's so many Cassandras around us, I think. But at the same time, how nobody's been there and back. So there is a sense of humility. None of us, doesn't matter how intelligent you are, how, you know, well-read, thinking in systems, multiple ways of knowing, etc. Can you put that all into one and be able to come up with a, like, it's going to be like this? What you can do is like, I've got the information that I need now. This is what I know now. And I'm going to act on that. Or maybe I'm not going to act on that. I'm going to bring in some other opportunities and other ways of knowing and other perspectives. The more perspectives you have, the more you realize how plural the futures are. It's just, as you said, it's almost like it's a bit mathematical that way, right? There's a multiplicity of them. Sometimes it's just about, okay, well, we'll try to narrow it down for some people, but keep in mind we can't, and these are speculations that we're dealing with. And how are we going to move with this uncertainty, not hold too tightly onto it, not to hold too tightly onto our assumptions, et cetera, to just move our way through it and ask ourselves, who are we doing this for? What is our purpose? Can we think about the next generation when we're making these decisions? I think that is something that brings in a lot of humility as well, is because there's a sense of responsibility in the present for creating the multiple outcomes from the decisions that we take or don't take today.
Well, and to go back to Jen's question around the broader notion of organizational adoption, or the way in which organizations can wrap their head around the value of foresight, how much of that is methods? And I don't just mean the methods of the foresight practitioner, which is an invitation for you to elaborate on that, but also the methods of the organization itself, right? The way that they think, the way that they deal with risk, the way that, to your point, they think of the next generation. How much of that is a dance between you presenting your methods and at the same time trying to get the organization to think about their own methods when it comes to thinking of the future or just making decisions in the present?
Yeah, well, I think WOA, the World Organization for Animal Health, did give it the old college try, and I think I did as well. So part of it is, it's a bit foresight by stealth. You can do things on an everyday, like use foresight every day, be foresightful. And it could be something very simple as, oh, look, you know, we're concerned about, at the time, I'll give you an example. At the time, we're concerned about COVID-19 appearing in farmed animals. Like, okay, we need to have a conversation about that as an organization. You don't need to go through grand gestures in terms, you're already working within their methods of like, okay, anticipation here. It hasn't happened yet. It might not happen, but like, how can we unpack this a little bit so that the whole organization, different parts of the organization can come together and say, right, if this happened, you know, the first order of impact, there would be absolute panic at the supermarket, borders would be closing, you know, trade would stop. And we just unpacked all this information, including what would come out of it from a technological perspective in terms of diagnostics, in terms of how we might run the general session, how we might need to come up with a new standard for how to treat this situation, speculative situation. And at those points, we decided, okay, here's how we're going to communicate this. Here's who we need to bring in to discuss this, because within this vast network we have, surely somebody's already asked this question and we just haven't put it out there yet. So let's tap into these different places. So that's what I mean by stealth and working within, you know, an organizational context and within their own methods. The other part of this, for like foresight to be really, I guess, accepted, you know, brought more into the organization, sustained within an organization, there's a very famous futures researcher who said that culture eats strategy for breakfast, meaning that sometimes you can have all the strategy, you can work out all the strategy you want in the world. You want the organization to look a certain way. However, the futurist is Suhail Inatola, by the way. But at the same time, if the culture is not creating an environment in which, you know, that strategy that you've come up with, you know, with all this foresight, insightful methods and whatever comes out of those methods, then, you know, you're just back to where you are again. So there's a bit of that. There's a real sense of socializing it as somebody who practices foresight, looking for the champions within the organization who will say, yep, I see this as something that's really useful. And then just doing it by stealth, you know, just little bits here and there, working with people in an organization of, you know, what's keeping them awake at night? You know, what, you know, they see signals in the air and they feel that there's changes coming. How can we unpack that?
Well, and I'd love for you to elaborate further on that cultural element and to give you a kind of hook to wrap it around. Complexity seems to be something that is both part of the role that foresight is meant to address, but also part of our culture. Like it seems part of the consequence of increased technology, of increased measurement, of a quantified society, is we are entertaining increasing levels of complexity, like factoring in climate, with health, with soil data, with animal data, just within the agricultural context. How much does culture play in facilitating or shutting down in the face of that complexity to your larger, rather brilliant strategy of finding the allies, finding the people you can work with, finding the champions who can help move this along? I'm kind of babbling in lack of a coherent question, but I'm trying to, on the one hand, reconcile the growing complexity that I think a lot of organizations face, the opportunity for foresight to help give tangibility, to give narrative, to give a vision to that complexity, while also recognizing that it's only so far as the culture will allow, right? If you don't have a culture that will allow for those connections, allow for that brainstorming, allow for imagining multiple futures, it kind of seems dead on arrival. So how do you navigate that? Where do you see the opportunities or the challenges there in terms of that larger cultural context?
That's an excellent question. And I think there's a couple ways of looking at this. There's the complex aspect of it. The beautiful thing that we're recognizing about complexity is how there's all these feedback loops and how we are... We see people thinking more in systems and more connections rather than silos. And, you know, maybe that's part of just recognizing, wow, we're in this real mess and actually you are too, and you are too, and you are too. Or we're in this real opportunity space. It doesn't have to be a mess, but we're in this real in-between space. And, you know, there are things that we are sharing, whether it's values or visions or what have you. So we recognize that what is happening in the world, what's happening with climate change, what's happening with soil health, what's happening with animal health, you know, everything all connected. And we're having these discussions about planetary boundaries, etc. So we're recognizing systems thinking, and we're recognizing the interconnections between everything. You know, everything is connected. And maybe there's no doubt about it. I'm biased in how I view these conversations going on and looking at them as hopeful, you know, pockets of opportunity and, you know, places where we can really use that complexity, if you will, or leverage that complexity in a way that makes us kind of break the current system and the current systemic thinking about how things are not, or the opposite of that, or some kind of version of that. So yes, a culture of an organization does play a big role in that, in terms of its operating or allowing the environment to unfold like this. By ignoring the complexity, I don't think anybody's doing themselves any favors. Not an organization, not individuals, what have you. And even listening to some of the episodes on your podcast, you'd start to, I think that was the whole point behind it, is to recognize how complex things are, but really how systemic and how interconnected all these aspects are. And it's bringing in this nice picture, a nice way of looking at complexity and appreciating complexity and being, as you had pointed out, having a little bit of humility in the face of that. Because there's a sense of control and there's also a sense of emergence. And the thing that I'm hearing mostly within this podcast is the emergence piece of it. And then just on that, thinking about the title of this podcast, when I heard future heard, I didn't think of H-R-E-D. I thought of you're hearing it, that it has been heard or it's being, you know, it's being valued. So in a sense, organizations are not boxes with walls and things like that. Organizations can be the communities that you are developing here and connecting with across Canada and across different elements within the food system. So that itself can be an organization. And we create these things. Organizations are people and they need to be connected with and heard and herded maybe in some ways too.
Hey, Tiana, can I just build on that for a minute? We're talking about like systems thinking and how complex everything is in terms of soil health and animal health. And when we're taking all of that into account, how do we manage mistrust or misinformation? Where does that fit into the discussion?
Yeah, like whose signals are we? Are these signals, the things that we're seeing that are driving changes, are they really, you know, to be trusted? Also organizations themselves, that's a good one. That is a good one. I don't have a real answer for it from a foresight perspective. From a, I guess, a scientific, person in the world looking at things from, yeah, it's a tough one. I don't have an answer for this. Let me just try to think about it a little bit more.
Well, let me accelerate it and give you a kind of case example maybe to flesh out your thoughts. Because something I've been dealing with that I've been trying to emerge or elevate in the podcast, and I think this is really the first opportunity where I can kind of close the loop, is the connection between the threat of zoonotic transmission, the threat of the kind of pandemics that people who are literate about this stuff are really concerned about, to the kind of technology or policy of traceability that we need to be able to monitor and recognize how illness spreads amongst domesticated animals, and the resistance amongst farmers who are swimming in a cultural environment of conspiracy and disinformation, in which they may not be literate or aware of the kind of zoonotic transmission threats that the scientists are, but instead see regulation and regulatory overreach as something that they need to fight. So to go to your earlier evocation of something I'm fond of, systems are breaking while systems are emerging, and they're not always the systems we want or need. How do you, as a foresight practitioner, wade into these contentious spaces? How do you help facilitate people imagining futures that are grounded in science or are grounded in real risk issues that we ought to be talking about, but are maybe blocked or culturally not accessible because of the nature of our current political climate.
Okay, well, thanks for clarifying that a little bit more, because I was expecting, I was thinking, oh my goodness, I have to answer something so huge that's so complicated, and having a case in point is a good place to start with. I'm going to say you meet people where they're at. You don't need to come with, you shouldn't, as a foresight practitioner, have futures already baked and presented to people. They have their own futures. There's one of my colleagues, friends, mentors, Josh Pulcher, who works in the foresight space as well, said it's not so much about what's ahead, but what's in your head that is the sort of essence of talking to people about foresight and futures, or not even talking to them about it. Just get in there and be stealthy about it. What is in their heads? Where is this coming from? And meeting people where they're at is super important, because it establishes they already have an established worldview of what things should look like. They're holding on to a lot of assumptions about the regulatory environment. They're hanging on to a lot of conspiracies, everything else. I think they need to recognize, or you need to recognize with them, what their lived experiences are in the present and the past, and what their decisions are for creating the futures. So a lot of the things that we see, just think about COVID or even avian influenza, something that's probably a lot more, tangible to us, every day. It's not that these things happen to us. We're creating the conditions for these things to arise. So there is a sense of agency. You need to go back to people's sense of agency about their worldviews, how they see the future, and have the discussions with them around what their perspectives are. Don't come in with something that's already baked. It's going to be mistrusted right away, because the underlying worry for them is that you're trying to control me. And that is the opposite effect. And especially when you've been regulated, you've had a lot of regulations, you've probably been a part of some of the discussions to develop those policies and regulations. A lot of that sort of us and them mentality comes out. And there's a way of just opening up the dialogue and letting what's in their head come out about how they see the future, how they see the present, and how they see the past. So again, meeting people where they're at.
Although you just said something incredibly radical that I would love for you to circle back and connect into this larger concept of public discourse or public perception, which is that we are creating the conditions for something like bird flu or COVID or, whatever threat may come next. I think there is still a popular perception, to use your word, agency, that we have very little, that there is a kind of determinism, an inevitability to the world. When instead, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you were arguing that we are facing the consequences of our systems, and there's a certain responsibility in acknowledging and addressing that. That is a contentious present. How do we allow for that to be part of the larger conversation? Because it feels, on some levels, not forecasting, but futurism is used as a way to ignore the problems of the present and focus on, say, a mission to Mars, rather than acknowledging the challenges our current systems are creating.
Yep. I'll just say yes on that one. That is, I think that's how a lot of people feel. That there is a lot of stuff that's already baked in, if you will, and they don't really have any choice over it. Yes and no. I look for the seeds of change that are already happening, that might be counter waves or, ripple effects. Not only ripple effects of things like, okay, well, we, we're getting off planet Earth, we're going to go discover Mars. And meanwhile, you know, what people really want is a future with healthcare and schools and, you know, and education and everything else. And why is all this money being spent on off planet exploration, etc.? And I don't have a say in any of that. Yes, that's how our current system is currently looking right now. But go ahead, you want to say something?
Well, I was going to, because you very graciously sort of acknowledged the existence of this podcast and the kind of aspirations of this podcast, I think what we can do now is kind of assume that we're addressing sectoral leadership, assume that we are addressing the people who, at least in Canada, and by my stats, some people in Europe, some people in Latin America, are listening to us and are thinking about the future of food and are thinking about the future of our mm-hmm. food systems. And so far, what I've found inspiring and empowering to the point of agency in terms of your perspective and your kind of method of engaging these subjects is it does suggest that we are in a position to imagine new systems. We are in a position to work with organizations to anticipate risk, even prepare for risk in really radical and revolutionary ways. So how would you, again, to focus it on the case example we're talking about in terms of animal disease transmission, human animal health, and the systems we have, what would you say to that agricultural, agri-food sectoral leadership, either on the role that foresight can play in empowering the sector, mm-hmm. or more specifically, how it can deal with these challenges around zoonotic transmission, around the necessary regulatory balance between the values of independent producers and the knowledge of epidemiologists who are like, we got to prepare for these major outbreaks. What's your thoughts on how to help prepare a sector around some of these very difficult tensions, which you are brilliantly articulating the context around? Let's extend this case example further and assume that there are people listening to us who had the ability to engage this level of organizational change.
Okay, well, maybe that will take me into sharing something with you that I thought of when I started listening to the podcast, right? And just said, wait a second, there's something going on here that is quite interesting. You're bringing in all these voices to the organization, or the organization, what I mean is what you're doing here in the future herd. And they have certain visions of the future. So let me just, if I can, I'll try to do this in a way that's efficient. There's something that a foresight method, I've thought, I'm going to listen to all these podcasts and try to map this out. But in the meantime, I'll share it with you and you'll see if this is of any interest to you whatsoever. So what we have is three lines on a page. This is called the Three Horizons method. It was created by Bill Sharp and Tony Hodgins. The first horizon is where we are today. We know that there's something, it's our sort of business as usual. This could be the agri-food system. There's something about it, how we got there, how it was created, and we know things are changing today so that over time, what we currently have is actually going to be limiting itself in a lot of ways. The third horizon is what we imagine what the future is. How we want to see the future. What are the futures we want to create? That could be the visions that we want to create. In this case, you can do it in multiple visions, if you will, if you want to use these boards in that way. There's stuff happening today. So if you imagine x-axis being time and what's happening today, and the y-axis being all the patterns that we are seeing predominantly in today. So today, the business as usual with agri-food system. The third horizon is this visionary mindset. We see that there are signals and seeds that tell us that these visions of the future are possible. And so what are they? How do we collect them? Where do we curate them, etc.? What is there that tells us that these things are, that these visions of the future are possible? And the second is where things get broken, if you will, or it's the messy middle. We're being a bit entrepreneurial. You know, we've identified challenges and risks and opportunities, etc. Sorry, there's a lot of questions on here, but I wanted to send this to you afterwards so that you can, you know, think your way through it. There are things that are directly impacting the system, but we want to move to H3. We want H2 to help us move to H3, the vision of the future. And what are those things? And the messy middle here is, if you're going to be an agent of change, who are you going to be working with? Like, what guidance are you going to give yourself to influence these changes, this sense of agency, this where we can go as a new or a different agri-food system? Maybe it's not even going to be called agri-food anymore. In between H1 and H3, there could be competing visions of what we want. But who are we going to work with, and how are we going to work with, and, you know, where do we use this opportunity, leverage this opportunity to get to the visions that we want? That's a very simplified, high level overview of what you can do with this information that you're collecting. Because I see what you're doing is you're collecting a lot of insights, and how can they be analyzed? If you will, sorry, going back to my sort of scientific way of imagining things, but how can they be analyzed? What can you do about it? What are these conversations that you're having that you can use actually as almost like communications products with farmers, with scientists, with the regulators, you know, with the university professors, all within this context and community that you're creating in Future Herd? So that's one way of doing it, and it just triggered that. It triggered me to think about that when I started listening to the different podcasts. Is people are talking about change, and they're looking at change in various ways, and there is a counter wave, or there's seeds being planted to tell us that tomorrow could and can look different than it does today.
Well, and what I love about this is it validates agency. It really foregrounds agency, particularly into your point about the seeds that can be planted today, which obviously resonates with agricultural types. But it also evokes an interesting thought that I'd love to kind of get your reaction to. You know, I appreciate your point about the messy middle, that inevitably in any grand vision, there's all sorts of compromises. And to use entrepreneurial languages, the necessary pivots that one has to make to, you know, build a successful initiative or organization. But the kind of vision that I'm getting from this interface, is it possible to measure? Like, could you engage in a process like this with an organization where, let's say, the stakeholders or the members say, yeah, this is a vision of the future we really want. And then every AGM you could measure as to whether the administration, as to whether the leadership is actually making progress towards that vision. Because it kind of evokes the legitimacy crisis that a lot of agricultural associations face, where they don't trust that their leaders are enacting their vision. And much like Britain is experiencing, they keep throwing out their leaders, so they don't actually make any progress towards the visions that they have, because they don't have the patience organizationally to allow any of those seeds to be cultivated. I guess to rearticulate this in the form of a question, I love that. I'm eager to see that, and I'll include it in the show notes for listeners to also go through. How is that then used as a tool or a handrail or even just a document to kind of facilitate not just that moment on the X-axis, but the movement forward, right? As those three graphs kind of dance and interchange with each other.
You know what I think would be really fun to do is if strategies were scenarios, if strategies were future visions. I know we say a lot, we talk a lot about visions within strategies and things like that. But if we opened up a strategy and it told us a story of multiple futures, and so to come back to that idea of how could we monitor that, scenarios themselves, you're supposed to use them. Strategies don't get used that often. I mean, they do. They do from a sense of, okay, it's an anchor to us. You know, we can go back to it and figure out what we meant to do and all that type of stuff. But imagine if we were picking up a book and it was a series of stories about agriculture. And we could even talk of those stories about the leaders within those stories and do the sort of, I guess, typical thing and do a bit of a dashboard on how that leader is living in those futures, what that leader is doing. And every time we have a almost like a charter, if you will, of how that leader is reacting within these futures. Who are they bringing in? What characters are involved? And then in the present day, we go back and say, are those competent? Do we have those competencies? Are they meeting those competencies in order to be emergent in this future as a leader that is adapting, that is, you know, in some cases might just need to survive. But the character that we've built around this leader, is it matching up with us? How can we support those leaders? And it won't just be one, it'll be multiple leaders. How can we support them so that they are thriving in those futures? So as opposed to just, you know, a strategy document that's like, you know, 2025 to, or 2026, I guess I remember now, 2026 to 2031, what if we're saying this is, you know, futures of agri-food, and you're telling the story based on those seeds, based on those signals that of change that you're seeing, and you're imagining those futures coming forward, and you're saying that these are the competencies that these leaders are bringing forward, these are the things that we're doing, and then maybe pinpoint back to, did those leaders do those things? What do we need to do to support so that we keep moving towards H3 and we keep leveraging what's happening in Horizon 2 to bring those futures forward? Now, again, everybody's going to want a different future, but there is a way of acknowledging that. That does acknowledge the multiple futures that we hold. And it doesn't just go, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z as an action plan, but we're treating the futures as something that we are living and that they are lived and they are being carried forward. The future and the past are present in the present. So we need to move forward with those elements. And that might be even moving forward in a zigzag fashion. It might be moving forward in a sideways fashion, but it's something. So that's one way. I think it would just be fun to do something like that, a strategy document that's a storybook about multiple futures.
Right on.
And how those characters would write in character reports.
Right on. Although maybe one of the... Go ahead, Jen, please.
I was just going to geek out on that, because as you're talking about, you know, the competencies that are needed and the discussions we've been having around leadership, how do we, like, even to get to that storybook, there's a whole lot of homework the industry has to do in terms of making sure our leaders are ready for that kind of leadership, and investments into the skills that are needed to be good leaders. I'm not disparaging the leaders that are out there, but Jesse's laughing because we've had a couple of podcasts specifically about the leadership part around the future of agriculture. Anyway, just me geeking out a little bit.
Well, no, and you can build what does leadership look like.
Well, I was going to say, Jen, why why don't you dig that a little further into a question? Only because I'm about to ask a question that's going to be a radical departure from where we are, although still building on the conversation. And I think, Jen, your point there about organizational capacity on the level of individual leaders is important. Do you want to either elaborate on that, or given that we are starting to run out of time, take this as an opportunity to throw in another question that you want to get in?
I'm not going to pose it as a question. I'm going to let you take it where you want to go, only because we are running out of time. And okay. I think what we're really saying is we need Tiana back on.
Happy to come back.
100%. We are just scratching the surface, and maybe this isn't a radical departure, but you've kind of evoked something a few times that I want to tease out, and it's the concept of the feedback loop. And I mean the feedback loop both in terms of the foresight process, but it also came up when we were talking about the dashboard. And granted, the dashboard is kind of the user interface of the moment. It's kind of the zeitgeist. And I keep trying to go past it by thinking about what is it that the dashboard is trying to address. And there is something important about the feedback loop, which we could articulate in the concept of leadership, right? That the leader goes out, communicates with the membership, gets a whole bunch of response and feedback, goes back, works on the initiative, comes back. Historically, that might have been only once a year at an AGM. Then it became email blasts, where it was maybe once a month, once a week. Social media initially made it instant, but I'm finding most leaders are retreating from that. They can't handle a high level of a feedback loop. So again, on an abstract level, where does the feedback loop rest in either the storytelling or the foresight process, or just in trying to make sense of the world that we find ourselves in? I kind of feel it was something that kept coming up in our conversation, and I want to surface it only to maybe set up the next kind of question that I'm leading to with this inquiry.
Okay. So the question is really, how do we use the feedback?
Or where do you see the role of the feedback loop in describing, I suppose, the aspirational qualities of the leader we've been talking about in terms of employing strategy, of having the humility to look at the future and to be curious about the plurality of multiple futures? I think Jen was kind of suggest these are rare characteristics in our existing leadership, but nonetheless, we want to cultivate it.
Yes, I agree. I think that's why it's good to challenge our assumptions about what leadership is and what it should look like, because we have a certain frame around leaders, and we all have our own individual frame of what it means to be a leader, etc. So there, I think that there's a real in the context that you're working in the agri-food, it's multi-relational. And I think that's where I was trying to also come back to. There's parts of the current system that you probably want to keep. You don't want to break it entirely, right? So there is this idea of, that's a bit of a feedback from the current situation. Where are the things that we want to preserve? So in terms of leadership, there's probably things in there about collaboration that is very normal for people to say. And I think a thing that we always fall back on, because we do it well sometimes and we don't do it so well in other times. And when you're looking at the feedback of when you're not doing it so well, what do you learn? What are the lessons that I have learned here that I don't keep trying to maintain the same system or the same idea of leadership? Just really need to break down those assumptions about what we think that they are and what we think that they should be. And that needs to go hand in hand. And this is where the system thinking goes in. It's not one thing before the other. When you're creating these visions of the future, the leaders are emerging And you need to step out of the what your current perspective on leadership is to what is emerging out of these multiple futures. And there are leaders within there. And they won't be, and they hopefully won't be, if you want to go into a particular space, won't be the same frame that you had from before. But there might be some things that have been preserved from your current way of thinking about leaders. So that's, I think it's just to be, your radar is on all the time, which can be exhausting. However, once you start seeing how things emerge and the interconnectedness of things, you cannot unsee it. And there's just sort of a sense of being suspended a little bit in the jello of it all. It, you know, it wiggles about, but there's some kind of matrix to it. There's, you know, some understanding of it, and you're suspended. And it's a sense of just, it's not floating, but there's a suspension. There's a suspension of what you have thought in the past, what you're seeing right now, and what the possibilities are for the future. So it's the only way I can sort of think about it, of just like you're kind of in like in this like little bit of a jelly, but not, that doesn't have much of a mold that changes its shape quite a bit. There's one thing that we keep thinking about actually at the Association of Professional Futures, and I'll just put it out there now, is that what are the shapes that the futures need? What are the shapes we need to be today for the futures? And we're thinking of it in terms of our competencies of looking at the future, thinking about the future, being with the future in a tangram type of, you know, these puzzles that it starts out looking like a square. When you break it all down, there's all these different parts and you can move them in multiple directions and you end up with, you know, thousands of different shapes. And so, yeah, it's very difficult because we have this frame that things have to be the way that they have to be. You know, there's just this and there's nothing else. But the truth is, you know, our lived experiences tell us something a little bit different. We need to shapeshift.
Well, and that is a very political statement, a revolutionary statement. And I think now that we are sort of nearing the end, it's kind of important to foreground a bias that the three of us share that has kind of underpinned our conversation today, which has been inclusivity, right? And it started with the concept that there are multiple futures. And then you also evoked it again when you rightly said that each of us has our own future and imagines our own future and will experience our own future. And that inherent inclusivity not only frames the brilliant concept you just described in terms of trying to imagine the shapes that we require for the future, which on an abstract level is very entertaining and intoxicating. But I think our assumption, our value of inclusivity, unfortunately, is not as widely shared as it should be, either in North American society or in the agri-food sector. You are connecting to us today from Europe, where Europe has its own issues around inclusivity, but certainly on an intellectual level has a different configuration than North America currently does. How much is both inclusivity a prerequisite for success in the world that you just described? Because that's my argument, that you have to have a certain open-mindedness to make sense of a complicated world, to make sense of the systems that we navigate in. And yet I do observe a lot of people reacting to that information overload by closing their mind, by employing prejudicial heuristics that might, again, counter with our a concept of inclusivity. I'm rambling again, but how do we make that argument on an organizational scale? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's it's a protection mechanism. There's a lot of information coming at us and we feel like the future is happening to us and we feel like it's being done to us and, you know, where do we have our agency and things like this. And the idea of the way we look at it, or the way I've looked at it, and I agree that bias is a really important thing to acknowledge wherever you're coming from, and recognize it in yourself, recognize other people's bias, but don't call them out. You need to label your own bias as you're going into these things. It's participatory. That's another way of looking at this, is how to make it as participatory as possible. Inclusivity, you know, there's definitions are cages, I find, in a lot of ways. So trying to balance all this out by using a different word. But when you try to get as much participation as possible, you are opening up so much more opportunity. And that opportunity, for depending on what worldviews you have, can be quite frightening for others. And so there's all kinds of things that we see happening. It feels like we're repeating ourselves in terms of our history. We're probably rhyming with the past rather than repeating it, because it's in different contexts and different periods of time. But we are doing things to kind of shut down. Recognize that that is happening, and do the participatory thing anyways. Just do it anyways. Yes, that is happening over there. Does that need to stop you? I don't think so. I would challenge you to keep going, whatever that looks like. Again, because the beauty of the fact that the future is not stationary, it is not a pinpoint, and you can, in some ways, move that needle in different places. It's not set in stone. It's being created. It's being written.
And let me follow that up by kind of offering a case example or offering a challenge. You know, one of the prejudices that exists within certainly the Canadian, if not the North American, agri-food sector is a prejudice against policy, a prejudice against regulation, without realizing that there's good policy and there's bad policy. There's good regulation, there's bad regulation. What would be your frame for why participation in policy, participation in regulatory conversations is essential to getting past that kind of cultural prejudice into the realm of agency, where people realize that policy can work for them, that regulation can work for them?
Yeah, well, it's an excellent question. And I think policy is in the eye. Policy is in the eye of the beholder, right? Like, how it looks is in the eye of the beholder. I think that just thinking back to my days in the Canadian government, at the CFIA, where it was really appreciated was there was the dialogue. I'm not sure if it's still happening today, but there was a dialogue, and things weren't prescriptive. There was an aspiration. You kind of had to figure out how you were going to get there. Did that work or not? Maybe that's a lesson that we can start learning. But for that lesson to be learned, you need to understand what worked and what didn't, and what could have happened and what we should have tried. And maybe now do we have an environment now that this will work? Because you have generations of people moving through different organizations, whether that's within agriculture, whether it's within government, etc. There needs to be this sort of operating environment, an environment that allows for this type of thing to happen. So I think it's really important. You can put policies out there and everybody ignore them, and then what's the point? Or you can put policies out there where people are part of, you can have disagreement and conflict. I think that's important and healthy, and allow for it. Yet at the same time, if there is a need for this regulation, let's put it in place, but you need to do it with I was going to say consent, but you need to do it within the rhythm of what is happening with the stakeholders. And that includes government as well. These things aren't just coming out of nowhere. These things are probably not great problem definition. So maybe we need to be spending a lot more time on defining what the problem is before coming up with the solution. And part of that problem definition comes from your stakeholders as well. Government everywhere, your livestock associations, everything. You know, you do need to take that into consideration.
Right on.
Long answer. So,
our last question, unless Jen wants to get in with one last shot before the buzzer, is kind of the shout out part of the show. And you've kind of done this already. You've quite wisely cited some of your colleagues and some of the other people who have inspired some of the methods that you've described. But who are the people you look up to? Who are the people that you kind of follow, that you learn from, that you think the rest of us should be paying attention to? Again, it's not a test. We're not looking for an exhaustive list, just a few names to kind of allow us to follow the threads even further.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, I came into Foresight, I was going to say by stealth a little bit as well, but also by a bit of surprise and just before COVID happened. So I had to do a lot of reading because I thought, okay, well, if this is, I'm being tasked to create this. I know very little. I need to start calling people up. And so that's exactly what I did. So people within, I was in an international organization, so the work that's being done at international organizations like the OECD and UNESCO, those were the first places that I called. And then there is the everyday futurist and Foresight who are people who are thinking more from a transformational perspective. And so that is people like Suhail Inantola and even my colleagues at the Association for Professional Futurists, being on the board there. They're coming from diverse backgrounds, and I learn something from them every single time because they are either working in private sector, they're freelancing, they're working with international organizations, governments directly, NGOs, museums. I mean, every time somebody says something about their project, I'm just completely blown away, including universities. It's like, why aren't we talking about this more? Why is this not part of our everyday living and education from a young age? And I think the other person I think of a lot is my daughter, because I learn something from her every day too. Like, you know, I have to think about how I'm raising her and how she's raising me so that, you know, in 7 years from now, she's, you know, has the ability to cope with what is emerging and what will emerge in terms of the multiple futures before us.
Right on. Fantastic. It's been a tour de force. Thank you, Tiano. As Jen inferred, we have to get you back only if because we've just scratched the surface of the kind of systems and transformative change that I think we all need to see happen. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure. And always, you always come out with thought-provoking questions, Jesse, and challenge people. And I really enjoy listening to this podcast and always enjoy having a catch-up with Jen as well. So thanks again.
Right on. These are the kinds of conversations that I aspire to have here on the podcast. And Tiana absolutely exceeded expectations, not just because she showed up having done the homework and listening to other episodes, let alone engaging in a Foresight exercise, which I'll share the link to the Miro board in the notes. But the generosity, the curiosity, the deep thought and reflection that guests like Tiana bring to this podcast is unprecedented, certainly for me, in terms of my experience as a learner, in terms of my desire to organize and share knowledge. But most importantly, what Tiana was talking about today in terms of multiple futures, in terms of inclusive and pluralistic futures. Because if anything, that's the antidote to the depressing times that some of us find ourselves in. hope isn't about being naive or even optimistic. It's about believing in futures that are within our grasp, that are not only achievable, but are morally responsible, things we should be working towards. And I really came out of this conversation with Tiana thinking that there is much more I can be doing to deal in manifesting the futures I desire, in enabling a plurality of futures for me, my family, my friends, and for you, fellow members of the herd. And of course, I do want to end on the idea that the future herd as a title has multiple meanings. On the one hand, we're a herd of which Tiana is now a member, much to our benefit. But it's also, we hear the future. We are listening carefully to our guests, asking them the kind of questions that push their thinking, that push their insights, that anticipate the kinds of multiple inclusive futures that we all require. So we are here, actively listening to the future. The future is heard, and if you keep listening, there'll be much more of the future to hear in the days and weeks to come. I am happy to say we've got a bit of a backlog of episodes, so we are going to try to release maybe two a week for the next little while. And so I encourage you to share these episodes with your friends. Give us ratings on your podcast platform of choice. We're now posting clips to YouTube, more incentive to subscribe to our channel there. And let us know if you have any ideas for future guests, future topics, maybe even interest in future live stream sessions here for the Future Herd. So much opportunity, so much potential, especially when we have such fantastic people like Tiana to talk to, as well as our co-host Jen, who of course played a big role in making today's episode possible. So thank you, Jen. And thanks to all of you for tuning in, watching, listening, sharing, and we'll see you again soon.